Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
The thing about being on the side of free speech is that you're usually on the side of the losers. Winners don't really need defending. They get to say what they want to say. Culturally, politically, socially, defending people's free speech rights means more than just protecting them from government interference. It means making sure there's a culture of freedom of expression. Right now, we're witnessing a lot of people who said they were concerned about free speech during the Biden administration lose their tongue as college campus protesters, immigrants, Palestinian rights advocates have their free speech rights threatened by the government and by society. And I'll be honest, I kind of get where they're coming from. I remember being a pretty inconsistent defender of free speech myself. When I was in college, I really thought that people who were promoting free speech were often just promoting right-wing talking points. And in some cases, they were. If you're defending free speech rights on college campuses in the United States, you're usually defending the rights of people who are unpopular on college campuses. Those people are usually right-wing. But I've realized how important it is to think through how to maintain a principled defense of free speech even when your side is winning. So I asked Greg Lukianoff. He's a president and a lawyer at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE. He's worked tirelessly to defend the rights of those on both sides of the aisle, and he's received flack from people across the political spectrum. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together people from socialists to conservatives to talk about the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Greg Lukianoff, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
It's not a fun time for free speech defenders, but part of this
depends on how much of a masochist you are.
I guess that's true. How much of a masochist are you, Greg?
Not that much.
Okay, so
out.
You're not having a good time. You know, a big part of why I wanted to have you on the show is because I've been thinking a lot about the failures of people like myself in really speaking out about a culture of free speech when liberals had more cultural and political power. And realizing that, you know, a lot of the arguments, you know, part of this was, you know, I was in college, so I don't put myself in the basket of people who had a ton of influence. But I was just reflecting on my own kind of blasé attitude towards the culture of free speech and the power that we all individually have in defending it and promoting it versus the literal letter of the law, right? Like, I think a lot of liberals were like, hey, you know, so college kids are shouting down people who are speaking on campus. That's not illegal. Yeah. That's not them. That's them protesting. And I want to ask you about those distinctions later, but I wanted to just like frame this conversation around that because I do think that there's a lot of, you know, I told you so's coming out right now, and I think that can be rightfully done, but we're also witnessing a lot of people on the right who used to be free speech defenders kind of turning again, and I think that there's this cyclical nature to which, like, people who are really consistently pro-free speech are always on the side of losers, and, like, that makes sense, because if you're a winner, of course you get to talk, you know? You're always defending the free speech right of the loser. So I just want to start with a simple but probably difficult question to answer, which is, what is the greatest threat to free speech today?
Oh, listing a single greatest threat. Generally, like, I'd say the greatest threat. Can I give a couple greatest threats?
Sure.
One, I'd say nationally, on a national level, I'm most concerned about the fact that I used to have sort of like a civil libertarian left. That's kind of the tradition I came from, and a libertarian right. That disagreed on all sorts of stuff, but were both very good on free speech. And I think the civil libertarian left has been kind of swallowed by progressivism. And I think the libertarian right has largely been swallowed by populism. And that's scary. And the next most important thing that's happening, or actually probably more important than this because it's global, is that we're seeing sort of a turning away from liberalism in general. And centralization of power. So, yeah, no kidding, like China and Iran are totalitarian states, but they've figured out ways to use things like AI to achieve an even greater level of nightmareness.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have places like my father's country, Russia. You know, it's just a mafia state, you know, that's a good old-fashioned authoritarian, you know, a mafia state. But then you end up having, you know, countries or continents like the European Union, you know, that are very dysfunctional when it comes to freedom of speech. Then you have the UK, where they're arresting, you know, dozens of people a day for what they say. So in a context where America is kind of standing alone, being like really purist on freedom of speech, mm-hmm. it scares the hell out of me that we're also kind of blowing it here.
Mm-hmm. Domestically, I mean, you mostly work in, and you get a lot of cases from mm-hmm. people who are asking you to help defend their free speech rights. Where are you seeing most of those, that incoming come from right now?
Oh, yeah. So generally, the biggest threat to you on campus, for example, and mm-hmm. we work beyond campus as well. But generally, if you're a professor, for example, most of the threats you're going to see come from a combination of administrators and students.
Mm-hmm.
And I say combination because, you know, it was only around 2017 that students started signing large numbers of petitions to get their professors fired for what they said, which is an ugly trend. It doesn't have a good historical parallel, at least not in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't have mattered if administrators didn't humor it and weren't already pretty hostile to speech they didn't like. And I'm talking about mid-level administrators are a huge part of the problem here. And that was most of my career, was either administrators or students or both. This past year, it's been the government. It's been government officials leaning on universities to get professors, you know, fired or punished for what they say. Then we're also just seeing a lot of government employee cases, you know, coming our way, a lot of protest cases coming mm-hmm. our way. It is, to use a very technical legal term, it's all a big mess.
Yeah. Is there one that keeps you up at night right now?
A particular case?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say I tend to get, and maybe it's like the whole, you know, fleeing the Bolsheviks kind of thing, and my dad growing up in horror.
It's in the genes, yeah.
Yeah, it's that when things are kind of bad, mm-hmm. I'm anxious.
Yeah.
When things are really bad, I tend to get kind of calm,
which is you kind sound of, a little calm right now, so that's, yeah. that's stressing
so,
me out.
So
yeah.
That's not a great thing.
Yeah.
When I calm down, because mm-hmm. that means like, but it focuses the mind.
Yeah.
You know to a degree. I would say, like, of the cases I've seen, I'd say the least appreciated is the attack on the law firms.
Okay.
The attack on the law firms is...
And remind us what happened there.
So, yeah. So basically, right when Trump started, he started going after the law firms mm-hmm. that were just the, you know, the homes to his critics. So,
yeah.
For example, he went to Robert Mueller's law firm. You know, he targeted them
mm-hmm.
and you know, dozens of others. And in some cases, they just included lawyers who had worked on, say, like with the January 6th committee,
mm-hmm.
for example. But in other cases, they're just ones who had opposed the government.
Yeah.
In his
first term.
In his first term, which is the idea that you would just punish, you know, people who fought you in a legitimate way, which
mm-hmm.
is through the courts. I'm not familiar with a good parallel to that. I mean, you know, Nixon tried some stuff like this, but
mm-hmm.
Just being so clearly going after your political enemies. And what they've targeted is security clearance and the ability to enter federal buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, by the way, a lot of the law firms really kind of disgraced themselves.
Yeah, they caved.
They caved immediately.
This actually really irritated me because it's sort of like, I understand if you are a, you know, undocumented immigrant,
sure.
you're not really going to stick your head up to
yeah.
to take on a lot of animosity from the federal government because they have the power to deport you and destroy your life, right?
Yeah.
Even if that's, you know, rightfully their purview under the law. So of course you're not going to stay up. But these law firms have tons of, I mean, these are millionaires. Some of these people are very well.
Multi-billion dollar law firms.
Yes, and they have the capacity to, and they know they probably could win a lot of these cases in the courts.
And when they started fighting,
yes.
they did.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some real cowardice there, but there are like places like Covington and Burling, for example, like who from the very beginning, you know, have been fighting. And since law firms have been fighting back more, they've been winning
mm-hmm.
because these tactics, you know, they're not okay. But I do think that the just the, sort of like the nakedness of the going after your political opponents. So like the three primary targets from even before the start of the administration were media, law firms, and higher ed. Basically things that are centers of left-leaning power.
Yeah.
And it's been in that sense, even though he himself can be very erratic, the overall strategy does seem to be, you know, to starve, you know, these institutions of resources as much as possible.
So FIRE really began, as you previewed a little bit, working on college campuses.
Yes.
And working to defend free speech of both students, professors, and in some cases administrators as well, on college campuses.
Yeah.
Why is that such an important place to defend speech? You know, I think that there's a lot of the reason why many people believe FIRE to be kind of a right-leaning organization, in part because defending free speech rights on largely left-leaning institutions means you're going to be pushing back against left individuals, left ideas, left frameworks. And there was a reason, though, that you guys started there. So can you tell me a little bit about why that's been a focus for you?
Just because that's what produces our knowledge is their single most important function. It's even more important than the educational part of it, is that we rely on our higher education system to produce expertise and to produce research that helps us understand the world as it actually is. And there are a few things more important than having a at least more accurate picture of the world. And if you start distorting speech in that environment, you are damaging our potential to have a shared reality as not just a country, but as a world. So it's especially important that you protect the marketplace of ideas in higher ed. And it is funny because, like, the, you know, I come from a left-leaning background. I was identified by Kathleen Sullivan, you know, at Stanford. And that's how I ended up, you know, being found by Harvey Silverglate, the kind of left-leaning co-founder of FIRE. And my very first cases were all people on the left getting in trouble, you know. But the reason why I bristle a little bit at when people, you know, stereotype FIRE that way is that it's generally they never really looked into us all that carefully, because the laziest habit, and I call this hypocrisy projection, that people don't know us very well. It's like, where was FIRE on, you know, Sami Alarian? Where was FIRE on the Stop Woke Act? Where was FIRE on, you know, like any of like the big cases, you know, over time? And I'm like, we defeated the Stop Woke Act in court. You know, Sami Alarian, you probably know about Sami Alarian because of us. Like, it's just every single case, we've always been there. But it is the case that the threats do tend to come more often, but not exclusively, from the left. But all throughout the history that I've been doing this as well, there have been threats from the right.
You think threats to free speech largely come from the left, or threats to free speech on campus?
On campus.
On campus. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's...
They're leftist institutions.
They're left-leaning institutions. Yeah. So, you know, so generally, if threats come from on campus, they come from left-leaning administrators or students. If they come from off campus, they tend to come from the right.
So a big thing that FIRE has focused on is this idea that shouting down speakers who come to campus is a threat to free speech.
Sure.
And I think that there's, you know, to steel man, like, the view that that's actually not a threat to free speech.
Yeah.
I think that, and, you know, I held this view for a long time too, which is that these are protests.
Yeah.
People are protesting. They're using their own First Amendment right to push back against individuals they view as outside the pale. They think that their ideas are wrong. They think they're bad. There are lots of kinds of protests I think may not be effective. You know, someone could dress up in very bizarre costumes and lie down in the street. I think there's arguments that a lot of the Just Stop Oil protests are ineffective in addition to having other potential legal problems.
Yeah.
But putting aside the efficacy question, why isn't it the right of students to shout down Charles Murray or shout down Helen Andrews or whoever it is?
Sure. I mean, it's just classic mob censorship. It's actually probably the oldest form of censorship ever, which is, you know, people deciding that you're not allowed to hear this person because I don't approve of them. And it's the kind of thing that I think when people experience it, when it's a speaker they want to hear and, you know, a group of students or anybody else comes in and says, you cannot hear this speaker because I disapprove of them, they get immediately that that's about as raw censorship as can be imagined, because the Otherwise, you just simply don't attend. But this is deciding that there's something polluted about this. You are not in control of yourself enough to listen to this person without being somehow damaged by it, or you're bad people, and therefore your rights don't matter either. Mm-hmm. It's an imposition. It's a very kind of like a school marmy kind of like idea, but backed up with at least enough force to actually carry out the shoutdown. Because we don't count it if someone's just, you know, booing or protesting. It's when they actually make sure the speech can't go on, mm-hmm. and that's not okay.
Well, what's the line there, right? If someone's booing and they boo for 30 seconds, I mean, like, how do you really think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we do this every single day, and generally the line's not at all hard to draw.
Yeah.
Like, if you make it so the speech can't go on, mm-hmm. That's a successful disruption.
Mm-hmm.
That's mob censorship for sure. If you're in the back and people boo and hiss a little bit, mm-hmm. and someone gets in trouble, that might actually be a fire case. Mm-hmm. But it's just it's a question, you know, of what was your goal, mm-hmm. and were you able to prevent that speech from going on?
But is mob censorship is that not constitutionally protected speech?
No.
Why not?
It's called a heckler's veto.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about why?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, because the Supreme Court recognizes the same thing. That mm-hmm. essentially, like, if you say, like, this person isn't allowed to speak here because his critics hate him so much they will throw bottles at him.
Yeah.
That is incentivizing people to throw bottles at their opponents. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's saying that it's recognized in First Amendment law that a heckler's veto is not okay, mm-hmm. because it does actually empower the least liberal members of your society to decide for everyone else who they are allowed to hear.
Mm-hmm. But throwing bottles is different than just booing, right?
Just booing, you know, like, is
that
something
counts
that's
as well.
Just booing is protected.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is what I'm talking about shoutdowns, about actually preventing a speech from going on.
Yeah.
That's not.
Yes.
And generally, the government has an obligation to actually mm-hmm. protect speakers, as opposed to give in to the will of the people who shut them down.
So why do you think that in recent years you've seen so much illiberal activity from college campuses? Like, where has that come from? Why has that energy been so strong? Because I think when I talk about this, I often get this rejoinder, and I'm reading the new, you know, William Buckley biography.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he obviously, when he was at Yale, he talked a lot about how these colleges are filled with leftists and leftist professors, and they don't let you talk about things that are more conservative. There's a huge, you know, illiberal culture. How much of this is just a continuation of an older kind of critique that's been made about universities, and how much of this is like you're noticing something quite different that you're alarmed about?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, the idea that there's intolerance on the left is something that you can trace back to the left saying it itself. I mean, that's where the term political correctness actually comes from, is from the left critiquing its own most doctrinaire, mm-hmm. you know, members. But certainly, you know, there are aspects of that on the ideological right as well. Intolerance and ideology go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
But it is kind of funny, though, when people talk about this as being sort of like cyclical to a degree. Because when you're talking about something like viewpoint diversity, when you're talking about like the political breakdown of the professorate, or for that matter, even of the student body, if that's a declining trend over the years and people are like, well, people were complaining about this 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yes, when it wasn't quite as bad.
Mm-hmm.
and if it continues in a decline, you should not be surprised that this comes up time and time again. And each time it's a little bit more intense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that scares me the most about the current situation is when we've polled at FIRE, the professors, we find that the younger cohort of students are much more, of professors,
mm-hmm.
are much more hostile to free speech and academic freedom and much more politically homogenous.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, it has this kind of declining quality to it,
mm-hmm.
that has led to a situation that was, over the last 10 years at least, worse than I ever expected to see in my career. Because
mm-hmm.
I've been doing this since 2001,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and I would say that when I first started, I was already shocked at how easy it was to get in trouble for what you said on a college campus. And this really intensified around 2014,
mm-hmm.
which is why, you know, I wrote the original article with my friend Jonathan Haidt, Coddling the American Mind, mm-hmm. you know, observing that basically like the premise being there that the same habits that are going to be a threat to academic freedom and free speech from this cohort of students is also going to be a disaster for the mental health of these students. Mm-hmm. What was the premise, and unfortunately we ended up being right on both counts. But it really intensified in 2017. That was the first time I really saw students joining petitions in order to get professors fired, at least in large numbers. And then 2020, 2022 through 23, I've seen nothing like it up until this year, mm-hmm. where we're seeing, professors being fired for angering government officials.
And I think a distinction you've made before that I find interesting is it's one thing to have students signing a petition to get someone fired, which is a free speech, a right that they have.
You have a right to.
And then there's another question of, like, why are administrators caving and doing this and allowing this petition to dictate their own.
But I do want to make a distinction here.
Yeah.
Is that FIRE generally doesn't comment on the content of people's speech, with one exception. Mm. That essentially, yes, we recognize your right to demand that the First Amendment be repealed, mm-hmm. If that's what you want. We're also going to argue against that.
Yeah.
So when students sign petitions, and this is an old argument I have with Randy Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Randy Kennedy would talk about our deplatforming databases, being like, but students have the right to protest mm-hmm. These speakers. And I'm like, if we were questioning their right to protest these speakers, we would be saying that they should be punished for mm-hmm. protesting these speakers. What we're saying is that if they succeed in getting all of these speakers to be unable to speak on campus, that's a disaster for free speech on that campus. That mm-hmm. means that anybody who invites those speakers, they should just give up because they're going to be shut down by their fellow students. So, what we're arguing for is that, they have the right to these illiberal attitudes. But it must not be the case that universities no longer invite speakers because students have become that intolerant.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about how you got into this work, because when I was reading up on you, I came across this 2015 article in The Atlantic about your story that I found really surprising. Mm-hmm. And it was about how your experience with cognitive behavioral therapy opened your eyes to the distortions that you were watching in the arena of free speech. I'm hoping you can draw the line between CBT and free speech defense.
Well, it's funny because being involved in the culture war all the time mm-hmm. gave me a mental breakdown back in 2007.
Yeah.
I was hospitalized as a danger to myself mm-hmm. in the Belmont facility in West Philadelphia in 2007. And it was partially just the sheer exhaustion of being in the culture war all the time, of holding fire together, of having this incredibly stressful job in which you're constantly being let down by people, outside the organization, because the conservatives will love you if they defend a conservative, but hate your guts when you defend a lefty, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And it's extremely alienating. And I wasn't really around, like, my friends or family in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. All of these things, conspired to me being in a really bad way back then. And as I was recovering, I was one of the things that really helped me. Now, first of all, getting back to be closer to friends and family made a huge difference. Having a really good therapist helped me. Actually, having a doctor reduce the number of pharmaceuticals I was on made a difference, but not. And I always want to be clear: I am not anti-pharmaceutical. Like, I was.
This is the MAHA moment. Yeah, you're coming out.
Yeah, I think that they are essential.
Yeah.
But you can be over-medicated at
totally,
the same time.
Yeah.
And also,
people respond differently to different medications. Yeah.
Yeah. This a treatment called EMDR mm-hmm. really helped me as well, but that was also super intense. And as I was recovering, though, the thing that really helped me long-term was cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. And what you do there in cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's the modality, with the most research behind it, is you talk back to the sort of intense voices in your head. Mm-hmm. So I always give the example of, you go on a date, it doesn't go well, and you say to yourself, I'm going to die alone. And CBT is not the power of positive thinking. It's writing it down mm-hmm. and asking yourself, really, is this rational? Mm-hmm. And if you know what cognitive distortions are, they're kind of like mental exaggerations that are irrational. And so right there...
The catastrophizing.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's catastrophizing.
Mm-hmm.
It's also mind reading. Mm-hmm. You don't actually know if the date was that bad. And it has absolutely been the case, I think, that everyone's had this experience where someone thought something was horrible and the other person was like, that was fine.
That was a normal interaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't follow that at all.
I'm flashing back right now.
Yeah. Exactly. And sometimes, of course, sometimes it's the other way around.
I know, yeah.
And then the idea that kind of like they didn't like you, so that's fortune telling. Or that you're going to die alone is catastrophic fortune telling.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these mental habits that you learn to be on the lookout in your own mind, which are really just the applied rationality to yourself, as long as you get in the habit of writing them down after time, and you have to do them right around the time that the thoughts kind of pop in your head, it starts calming you down in the short term, but it really starts some of those like crazy voices in your head like lose some credibility, let's put it that way, in your own mind. And you'll hear like the, you know, it's like, you're going to die alone. And like in your head, and you're just like, that's pretty funny. You know, like, that's not going to get me this time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I even had like my therapist actually, I just even used a technique he recommended, like sometimes hear it in a funny voice.
Yeah.
You know, being like, whatever, dude.
Mm-hmm.
You always say that stuff. And while I was getting so much better, thanks to CBT, I was watching the behavior on campus with the adults in the room, basically on campuses, feeling like they were telling you, do overgeneralize, do catastrophize, do engage in fortune telling, do engage in all of these cognitive distortions.
Can you give an example? Like, in what way?
I remember there was a professor who put a picture up of his daughter doing yoga in a Game of Thrones t-shirt.
Okay.
That
where is this going?
exactly. That had something like it had a quote from Daenerys Targaryen that was like something like, "I will take what is mine with fire and blood" on it. Literally a picture of his daughter,
okay,
doing yoga
in
a Game of Thrones t-shirt. And he put it out on Google Plus to give you an idea of how old this was.
TBT.
And administrators at his school in New Jersey decided this is a threat, clearly, because I will take what is mine with fire and blood, which is on the t-shirt, which you actually had to kind of squint to even see the
threat to what?
Yeah. That they sent this incredibly overheated email about like the fire could be the fire of an AK-47, for example. And the thing
is, this a conservative? Is that why?
What's that?
Was the professor a conservative?
Or? I don't think so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they catastrophized.
Yeah.
They overgeneralized. They did all of this stuff. And I was used to this kind of stuff, this kind of risk management craziness type stuff where the administrators would hyper overreact to something as if it could be like a really serious threat.
Mm-hmm.
I had one of my favorite cases actually involved a quote from the TV show Firefly.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What? I love that show.
That was one of the ones where there's this quote where basically like he's saying to the doctor that I won't bushwhack you. I won't.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, listen, if ever Ken blows between the two of us, and I were to kill you, you'd be facing me and you'd be armed. And it's like a badass way of saying I play fair.
Yeah.
But so a drama professor put like this quote on his door. The bias-related program comes around and he gets in big trouble for having that up because that's a threat to the community somehow.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of catastrophizing I was seeing happening all the time on campus.
Mm-hmm.
But at least prior to 2012, for the most part, students were kind of rolling their eyes at it, not taking it all that seriously.
You know, it's when I hear stories like this, sometimes I wonder, because, you know, even in this conversation, like, I've referenced this as left versus right kind of ideological capture by illiberal forces. But at the same time, like, when I hear it, is a bureaucratic problem in many respects.
It
you
is
know?
A huge bureaucratic
like,
problem.
And I, you know, I've worked at bigger organizations. I've worked at very small organizations.
Yeah.
And big organizations sometimes, especially when you rightfully, you know, are empowering middle tier managers to go and excel in a program, they can, like, you know, it's like what they sometimes say about I hope I'm not just making this up, but sometimes they say this about like local officials in the CCP are like way more intense than like the federal officials because they're just trying to be the best soldiers possible for the mission they've been granted. And so like the strongest true believers are often not even like the heads of organizations. Like college presidents themselves are often like quite concerned about what's going on under their purview, even as they're the ones in charge.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of times it seems like these bureaucratic problems that are being pointed out are not even really about ideology. They're just someone's been handed a program, and they've been told, hey, you need to make sure that there's no bias shown anywhere in any kind of public communications. And they like walk around, they're like, well, I have to find something, I have to show that I did something, let me show that I'm a good employee. Yes. And then that can lead to overzealous enforcement, and then this kind of like weird legalistic.
This is absolutely it. I'm so glad you're saying this, because I've spent so long trying to get people interested in cases that were neither right nor left,
mm-hmm.
that were just administrative craziness, abuse of power, overreach, hyper-compliance type stuff. And it was so hard to get people to take this seriously. Like, people wanted to know if it was a right or a left case. Now, what ended up happening after 2014 is the two kind of blurred together, because you have this kind of bureaucratic over-compliance.
In service of.
Yeah. And then you also have, some frankly pretty left-leaning administrators who, mm-hmm. when the more left-leaning students complain about something, that they're much more kind of like, we have to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got risk management meeting ideology, and the perfect storm it created was really bad.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I do think that people kind of miss about the last 2 years with the pro-Palestinian protests,
mm-hmm.
is that was actually the reason why it got so bad after 2014. And I wrote a book called Canceling in the American Mind, talking mm-hmm. about like how bad the number of professors losing their jobs actually got after 2014, because it was just, we didn't see anything like it, like, ever. And the at least since the law was established, mm-hmm. protecting academic freedom and free speech, which was between 57 and 73,
mm-hmm.
Thereabouts. And, like, nothing even vaguely close to the kind of explosion of professors getting targeted, that we saw up until, of course, the current, horrible situation.
I think, I'm a left liberal, and as I mentioned at the top of the program, I've been thinking a lot about and reflecting why it felt quite easy when I didn't feel my speech was threatened.
Yeah.
When I was on college, I didn't feel like my speech was threatened at all. I didn't feel like I couldn't say what I wanted to say. People disagreed with me. People got mad at me for things. People to my left and to my right got mad. I went to school at the College of William Mary, so I think I had a slightly more like conservative student body on average than most people who went to college who I know. But I didn't really feel that much of a threat. And I heard people saying things like this. I graduated in 2017, so really at the height of a lot of the Me Too movement, but also a lot of the, the beginnings of a lot of, there was a lot of illiberal sentiment kind of building on college campuses, but also on the left writ large. And there was even, I think, in response to the Trump administration
and
in response to Trump, I think saying a lot of things that people felt were so abhorrent that it required some sort of like speech crackdown in the places where the left had power, which was largely workplaces and cultural institutions and places that, were beyond usually the purview of the law. And, I said this to a couple of friends who are also on the left, and they, accused me of false equivalence, because mm-hmm. I think that this is a point that has some merit, but I think they're taking it too far, which is that there's a difference between the government sending you a letter, like, mm-hmm. Russ Vought sending a letter to a private institution telling them don't do these things which are constitutionally protected speech, and private institutions doing things that we may think are like, you're not behaving the best, but you're a private institution. And I wonder if conversations like this, like the one we're having right now, do they contribute to that false equivalence?
Mm-hmm. False equivalence is something that I'm constantly being accused of in the past couple of months.
Yeah.
And I honestly have to stop people and be like, but which side are you accusing me of this from?
Mm.
Because both sides believe that the other side is engaging in false equivalence.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like always like a sign of like how deep in someone's sort of own partisan hole they are.
Yeah.
Is if that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're explaining like what was going on with the left, people are like, the one that bothers me the most is just students complaining about stuff. It's just powerless students complaining mm-hmm. about stuff. I'm like, if it was powerless students complaining about stuff and administrators weren't actually firing these professors, then we'd be on the student's side on this stuff. We'd probably hope that they wouldn't complain as much about, professors disagreeing with them, mm-hmm. But so what? The problem was that you had a cohort of administrators who were, in some cases, even organizing some of these protests. That's actually what happened at Stanford, for mm-hmm. example. They were encouraging a lot of the stuff and were Following through with getting professors punished, getting articles retracted, getting doing things that was devastating to people looking from the outside's trust in the institution at all. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't if there wasn't the element of power, and oftentimes, by the way, state employees. So yeah. It's not like there's this clean line. If you're in a state school and you get fired, you're a tenured professor and you get fired for your speech, that is a state violation of your rights. Mm-hmm. On the other side, of course, you know, the right will always point to things like job-owning social media companies and all this kind of stuff, and that is bad, and we've always opposed that. But, you know, like when you're actually talking about, you know, lawsuits, you know, from the President of the United States, for example, or the use of his FCC, mm-hmm. for example, which, to be clear, everybody's abused the FCC over over decades. Like at this point, I'm just totally cynical about that institution. but that essentially those are the biggest concerns, which is one of the reasons why when people talk about cancel culture in the Trump administration, in Trump administration part two, I'm always like, no, to be clear, this is worse. Like when you're talking about, you know, the state leaning on you to get someone fired, mm-hmm. in a big way, that is actually, you know, worse than a mid-level administrator doing it. Mm. Still, one does invite the other. And so like the false equivalent argument, it's like, I mean, I live here, so I get to sort of like see how people are really great when they like the speech and really bad when they don't. Mm-hmm. But I do think that I feel like there's no kind of fixing sort of like the epistemic institutions, the knowledge creating institutions, unless people on the left actually realize they might have been doing something wrong too. Because even if the threat from the right were to go entirely away, mm-hmm. they would still need to do some reform.
So, I mean, in an optimistic world, you know, we continue to see free and fair elections in this country, and that means, I mean, even without free and fair elections in this country, you know, the power of the different ideological sides is cyclical, right, to some extent, even though the cycles are not always the same length. And the left will be in power again in one way or the other.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. I've been thinking about, like, you know, how many people on the right thought they were such consistent defenders of free speech.
Yeah.
And now that the Trump administration is in power, now that cultural power is swinging back towards the right, now that a lot of people in powerful companies, particularly in the tech world, have become more immune to criticisms about bigotry or things like that from what they consider social justice warriors, you end up seeing that a lot of these people, similarly to the left, are actually willing to countenance a lot of threats of free speech when it comes to their own side being in power. And so, you know, I mean, I don't want to just talk about hypocrisy. I want to talk about how you inoculate yourself from that in the future, because I think that it's actually quite difficult to know you're doing it while it's happening. You know,
yeah.
I think people are not meaning to be cynical hypocrites. You know,
yeah.
I think they genuinely do view the things that their side is doing as different. And I wonder, like, do you ever feel pulled or cross-pressured in defending free speech? Is there a case where you felt like, I'm not sure about this one, or how do you maintain kind of your consistency?
You know, we always discuss the pluses and minuses of cases like really carefully, and we take the counter argument seriously, you know, at FIRE, and try to really, you know, put ourselves like in the shoes of the government under those circumstances. So, for example, the job owning I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about explain that?
Job owning is when the government leans on, say, like a social media company, mm-hmm. most famously, to censor speech that the government itself is forbidden from censoring.
So basically, Biden did this during COVID,
where
the Biden administration leaned on Facebook primarily, but also Amazon, to ask them to kind of censor COVID misinformation because they were afraid that was going to get people killed.
Yeah. And the Trump administration is doing the same thing now.
Yeah.
With information about where ICE is, under the argument that people are now violently targeting people who work for ICE.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, these are both serious arguments.
Yeah.
And if you pretend that they're not, that's all another way you can show your sort of like partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that doesn't have any effect on First Amendment rights, that the government should not be leaning on companies to ban speech that the government itself is not would not be allowed to punish.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's, and we just learned today, for example, that Facebook removed a Chicago group that was talking about like where ICE might actually be located, under the argument that that potentially could be used to violently target them. To our knowledge, it actually hadn't been used to violently target them. But making sure that you're taking what your opponent's argument is seriously, and then nonetheless being able to explain why. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that's so helpful about working in a place that's genuinely politically diverse like FIRE, is you need to have people in the room to actually disagree with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it really helps, not if they're just playing devil's advocate, if they actually believe you are wrong.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference. So I think viewpoint diversity helps a lot within within our institution itself, and it's something that we really try to maintain.
How do you think about building an institution with viewpoint diversity at a time when the institutions of higher learning are so biased towards the left? And again, biased sometimes in ways that are unfair, and other times because we see just a self-sorting of conservatives and liberals into different professions. There are just more liberals who go to law school. There are more liberals who go to higher education.
Yeah. No, it worries me, and it makes it a very hard problem to fix.
Yeah.
And I think that I think a lot about what I call structured friction, like the idea of like how, because I, this is one of the reasons why I love a lot of the thinking that went into the Constitution. A lot of it was and very much influenced by people like not just John Locke, but almost more importantly on this topic, Montesquieu, like who believed in separation of powers and all this kind of stuff. And the theory was essentially human beings are deeply flawed creatures. I can wish all day that people, you know, are suddenly, you know, commit themselves to objective truth and are fair and reasonable all the time. But let's be honest, people are still going to be people. So you need ambition to counteract ambition. You know, one of my favorite lines ever written by anybody was James Madison in Federalist 10, I think. And you need that because that's actually how you create knowledge. Because if you just sort of assume, well, hopefully one day people won't be biased. No. Like we're like here's one of the more depressing facts about that, by the way. Higher IQ people and more numerate people actually can be better at convincing themselves in the direction of their own politics.
This is actually why I think you see, well, in part why you see higher mental illness rates amongst higher IQ people is because you can cognitively, like get, you can get yourself into cognitive distortions very, very easily.
So really what you need is something to offset it. So when I think about some things that would be really helpful for higher ed, I don't necessarily think of, I think of things like co-taught classes, you know, where basically you have someone who disagrees, usually within the discipline. I'm not just saying like at a Republican.
Random person, yeah, yeah.
I'm saying like someone, people who actually look at politics a different way. And it, they could even be potentially on the same side, just as long as they actually have sharp disagreements.
Yeah, it's not really that relevant in physics, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why, that's why I'm not sure you need co-talk classes and that kind of stuff. But I do think that, partially because it also deals with the fact that people are just regurgitating what they want, they think they want their professor to hear, what the professor wants you to say, which is basically say the same thing as I do.
Totally.
Yeah, two professors, you know, you would actually, you might have to think for yourself, you know, which would be kind of nice. I think about things like that. I know that Daniel Diermeier talked at Vanderbilt talked about the idea of basically having departments that, you know, exist to sort of like check each other, you know, essentially to be like, okay, you know, like let's take a quantitative approach to a lot of your political assertions. Let's see if they actually hold up. I think we need a lot more structured friction.
I strongly agree. I actually wrote an article recently for The Argument about why we're going to need to do DEI for conservatives. A big part is like I still really, and you know, it's obviously that headline's a bit tongue in cheek there, but I mean, I still really do believe that diversity of across a range of areas is like extremely important for higher education. Racial diversity, ethnic diversity, nationalist diversity, gender diversity, but also ideological diversity is like
also,
extremely
also,
important.
By the way, class diversity.
Class diversity, certainly.
I've definitely found something that's been pretty consistent throughout my career. And certainly there are some institutions that do really badly, like University of Indiana. But big state schools generally are going to have a healthier intellectual environment than a lot of the more sort of, you know, when I have to show my cards on this one, just the schools that only the rich kids go to.
Yes.
You know, like they tend to have, it brings in a certain amount of groundedness, a certain mm-hmm. amount of, naturally it brings in some viewpoint diversity, you know, like all of this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. I tend to think that that's one of the things that you see, or these institutions just tend to be healthier.
Yeah. I mean, I want to talk a little bit more, because I know you just mentioned taking seriously the opposition view. And, you know, so, you know, when I was in college, I was in at a higher level. It was an economics class. And I don't want to out the exact class. I don't want to out the professor or anything like that. But I was in a high level economics class. It was a small class. It was a seminar.
Yeah.
And the professor, you know, it wasn't really related to what we were talking about. Got up on the whiteboard and drew two bell curves
mm-hmm.
and then said, you know, one of these bell curves represents female IQ and one of these bell curves represents male IQ.
Yeah.
And so you had fatter tails for the men, which
yeah.
meant that you had higher, you know, more men who had really high IQs and
really low
IQs
low ones, yeah.
and women who had fewer women who were on the extremes and more bunched up in the middle. Now, I don't want to get into like whether or not this is true. I think it's like beyond the scope of this. But I just mean
yeah.
like, you know, in that moment, I mean, I think that like he was not trying to engage in a like conversation about the science behind IQ, because again, this was an economics class and like nobody in the class had any
yeah.
idea what to say to this. It was a it felt like a pointed commentary about why there were fewer women in this class,
yeah.
why there were not very many women in higher education in the highest levels of economics,
mm-hmm.
and that we should just assume that that's natural. And again, like, I don't, you know, I don't. The science of this is, I think, disputed for various reasons, and like people have different views on this. And I happen to think it's probably not true. It's very similar to what I think Larry Summers said
yeah.
when he was president of Harvard. And I know personally women from that class who did not continue to pursue economics classics. They felt so alienated
yeah.
in that conversation that they were like, "Well, if this is how it's going to be, like, well, I'm just going to go back to my American studies or like whatever it is." And I think that in many ways, like, the there's a power asymmetry inherent to the professor-student relationship,
mm-hmm.
and there's a level to which when professors say things that are alienating things, I mean, that's a pretty, I think, cancelable thing, particularly in 2017. Like, you know, if that had been a firestorm at William Mary's campus, I wouldn't
yeah.
have been surprised if fire had been involved in defending that professor's right to make those comments to his students.
Yeah.
But there are real costs to mm-hmm. intellectual diversity if there's not, in a world where, you know, students don't feel empowered to band together in this way. And I think mm-hmm. in many ways what we saw in the 2016-2017 time period was students learning solidarity again in many respects to push back against professors they felt were making offensive or harmful comments. And I understand that there's like other ways to protest, like we could have
yeah.
responded to him, but like there's a way in which, you know, like I think that there has been a real reaction against students at all having those rights. And I wonder how you think about that dynamic and that problem.
Well, I mean, you certainly have the right to complain about, you know, what you're taught. But I
yeah.
do think that given the special role, I mean, really the only thing that sort of justifies all the special protections we give higher ed
mm-hmm.
is that role in truth seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And truth seeking doesn't work if you have too many taboos about what hypotheses and what level of thought experimentation, what levels of devil's advocacy can actually be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
So really, like, I think that telling students, you know, essentially that they have they can report their professor for making the long tail argument,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is not, you know, I'm not going to obviously take a position on whether or not it's true, but there
are people who believe this. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's a serious actual debate and discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And if that becomes off the chart, like that's something off the table that you can't actually have that argument. And I think a lot of these things have, it increasingly distorts the world of what you're allowed to argue
mm-hmm.
to a point at which nobody's going to trust you anymore outside the institution to actually basically you end up with a perverse incentive that essentially, because higher ed is so skewed in one direction, since everyone knows they have these kind of taboos, they're going to trust you less when you actually say something that seems to confirm the opinion of sort of like upper class left leaning
mm-hmm.
professor. They're going to be like, okay, that's probably what you wanted to find.
Yeah.
And you're actually going to have weirdly more credibility if you actually are counter it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the thing that really pushed me is that, and I remember the thing that got me really, really frustrated at the time is I didn't actually know the debate at all.
Yeah.
He just, like, said this. I had not come across this argument before. And I remember just feeling, like, really angry and frustrated, because I was, like, I was going to go do the deep dive, honestly, like, to go find out, like, where this idea came from or whatever. I was just, like, frustrated. I thought it was a sexist thing to say.
Yeah.
And I was, like, irritated that he had said that to our class. And I wanted someone to tell him to, like, stop. And that's I just wanted that to, like, be over. And I realized afterwards, a while later, when I was thinking about it again, it's that if, you know, when I remember I read a lot about, you know, a lot of the IQ debates and became more familiar with the literature and the counter arguments against it, you know, the thing that is actually really empowering is, like, learning what you actually believe and why your arguments are right. Like, why is that wrong that he said that? Like, why is he incorrect about that? Like, those are questions that are actually ways that students can be empowered to, like, say their own views. And I think the biggest problem we've seen in a lot of the, in the, not just colleges, but I think just the epistemic environment of even media, I think, and also in public health and other kind of truth-seeking institutions, is that there's sort of, like, a lot of people don't actually know the counter-arguments anymore. Like, you've stopped telling, like, you stopped making the argument in public about why the left doesn't believe X or Y, and now I'm like, hey, like, why do you think racism is bad? Like, can you even, like, answer that question?
This is what John Stuart Mill's, you know, argument, I call it Mill's Trident, is my nickname for it. Most of what you say, actually, generally, like, most people aren't engaged in truth-seeking all the time. Like, that's normal. Most of what we say is what we like and what our preferences are and all that kind of stuff. But in a truth-seeking argument, there's really only three possibilities. One, you're wrong. So obviously you need free speech for someone to point out that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Two, that you're partially right, partially wrong. Mm-hmm. And then you need that discussion to have a, you know, a firmer picture of, like, to get a little closer towards the truth. But then three, God forbid, and this doesn't happen all that often, but you're 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just completely right. Well, in that case, the problem is that you hold your belief like you hold a prejudice. It ends up just being something that you know is right.
Yeah.
You don't really understand why.
Mm-hmm.
You've just been kind of told it. It's just sort of received wisdom. And he made the point that even under that circumstance, you still need it to be able to be challenged so people can think through how you got to that conclusion in the first place. And I've watched this in action on campus because, you know, I come from a left liberal kind of background, not left progressive background. And I would watch people in these debates on campus, you know, sometimes, and it would be like a left, what I would think of as maybe like a left liberal, like up there too, being asked about, you know, to defend affirmative action or defend any of these things. And I could see that they didn't really know how, because they knew they were right. They didn't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to go through those steps. Otherwise, you don't have a lively impression of truth.
Yeah, people always dunk on college debate, but college debate actually helped me with this.
Because
you were forced to defend sides that you really didn't hold.
Yeah.
And then you found yourself going, like, well, that's actually not that. That's actually quite difficult to respond to, you know?
They dunk on college debate?
A lot of people are like, well, debate kids, you know what I mean? They're very annoying. We have, like, a specific way of talking that's quite fast.
I think
you love
awesome.
Us. Yeah. Lawyers love debate kids because we all become lawyers. So one thing
I was more of a quiz bowl kid.
You were a quiz bowl? Okay. I did quiz bowl briefly in high school, but wasn't as good. So I want to ask you about speech in the age of social media.
Sure.
Because I think that a lot of the arguments around, you know, truth will out, that, like, good speech can beat bad speech, can be more persuasive.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, no, I mean, I don't think liberals have ever been, like, Pollyannish a bit about this.
Sure,
it's not
yeah.
the case that, like, always truth will out or that's whatever. But the idea is that, on average, more persuasive arguments can find footing, that, but also that there's no way for them to ever find footing.
Exactly.
In a world
at
where,
absolute minimum, if you can't actually challenge something, you're not going to get
there's no
anywhere.
World. Yeah. So that you should not be in favor of suppression of speech. But I think that people point to the new age we're living in with social media and the control an individual can have, for instance, Elon Musk over the way that the algorithm works on Twitter. And I mean, we can even see, you know, there were allegations made, at least, that he had forced software engineers to change the code to promote his tweets, or to clearly the moderation policies have changed to allow certain kinds of content to become much more normal. And I think that, like, you know, it's consistent with a liberal worldview that you can have moderation of social media content of some sort.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that there's this way in which I think the age of free speech really came about in the age of the printed word.
Yeah.
And I think it really is conducive to a world where there are publishing institutions and there are newspapers and there's some sort of friction and delay in how speech works and how speech is disseminated for various reasons. But now I think we're in an age where you can be inundated with lies.
Yeah.
And that will never, ever be fact checked, that you could never, ever be shown to be false. And now Sora, which is the new app that OpenAI has released that allows you to create, like, you could create, I could create a video of you saying that you actually think the Trump administration is great on free speech.
Yeah.
It could travel across the entire world. And
don't
give anyone ideas. But I mean, it just, like, it would be very easy to do. And soon we will have that everywhere at a level where, I mean, I think it's possible we can have some technological solutions to this, but I think it's probably unlikely that you can really solve this problem. So in that world, isn't it more necessary to have some sort of government regulation of speech to ensure that lies are not disseminated as truth, that in a way that really can incite bigger problems?
I mean, government power is ultimately what we're the most afraid of. And when you look at the printing press, you know, and that's, you know, the technology that, like, I spent a lot of law school studying, the power wanted to control it so it could control the nature of truth itself. And that's the stuff that scares me the most, which is why when the Biden administration kept on repeating misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation, I'm like, that's scary to me because it's like the government wanting influence on over what is true is kind of the whole ballgame, you know, and we see Trump doing this now, too. He's been making, like, all of the same arguments that the left was making, particularly in the wake of the murder of Charlie Kirk. You know, like, he was arguing hate speech. You know, you shouldn't be saying bad things about him after he died because of hate speech, making misinformation and disinformation arguments about Jimmy Kimmel, like what he said. These are all powers I do not want to be in the hands of power, you know, essentially. So that's always my biggest concern. The antidote to a situation of epistemic anarchy is our authorities that we can actually trust. And my big concern is that authority has done a lot to undermine its own credibility. Now, to be clear, anytime there's a massive expansion in the number of people who are involved in a global conversation, our faith and expertise plummets, partially because we're made aware of the fact that, you know, like what happened with the printing press. Actually, it turns out that Aristotle was wrong about a whole bunch of things.
You know? And I mean, famously, the printing press is in part responsible for the Protestant Reformation, the European Wars of Religion. I mean, it leads to a lot of discord.
Absolutely. It's a disruptive technology. I remember when people were saying this is an accusation against me in height, you know, like saying that, well, I bet these guys thought the, you know, like would have complained about the printing press too. And I always want to say, the technology that doomed Europe to 150 years of religious war, there are some criticisms of it. Over the long term, totally worth it. But on the short term, the idea that it wouldn't be highly, and this is something I actually almost like try to repeat to height, essentially, to be kind of like, listen, there's no avoiding in the age of social media and AI, there being like a highly disrupted period. But culture adapts to it. You figure out institutions that actually allow you to have, because like the only way you're going to be able to deal with the people making, you know, Sora videos is to have somebody that people, it's never going to be quite universal, but that most people actually trust to, that's always been fair about
this
stuff.
That can say, that's true, that's not true.
And that trust, and that kind of trust literally can only be earned. And this is one of the things that why I think like higher ed did so much to undermine its own credibility, is it kind of got this primitive idea in its head that since I know what social justice is, I can, you know, this happened in journalism. You know, like, and like a lot of First Amendment people, I come from a student journalist background and was really horrified to talk to some of the younger students maybe 10 years ago who had this idea that my job is not the, the just explaining what the world actually looks like, but my goal is to change it for the better. And it's like, but you do get that people aren't idiots. And if they see that's what you're trying to do, they're not going to trust you anymore. You know, like, so there was this idea that they kind of forgot that sort of trust element to it. So I think we need improved institutions. I think we need a lot of reform and a lot of them. I think we probably need entirely new ones. But they can't be instruments of direct coercive power. It can't be like the government. It's one of the reasons why I think the Stanford Internet Observatory was kind of like such a bad idea, because it's like I went to Stanford.
Yeah.
It's like people shouldn't trust people from Silicon Valley to be plugged.
That's
into
something
the
America
world.
Can agree about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's mm-hmm. It's a lovely, pleasant little Disneyland bubble, mm-hmm. But it's a little detached. So I think that we need to figure out what these are. I do actually think, to some degree, some people have sort of raised their hands on Substack, for example, of being mm-hmm. kind of like, I've actually been pretty reliable, you know, for a long time. And I think that that's usually what happens. And that's kind of what the scientific revolution really was to a degree, and the Enlightenment for that matter, mm-hmm. was a handful of individuals who showed some integrity, actually showing that they were reliable critics of what received wisdom actually was.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've written for the Free Press. You've written a lot of things for the Free Press on defending free speech. And I think they've come under, I think, quite legitimate criticism for not being equal critics of the Trump administration's illiberalism mm-hmm. in a way that I think a lot of people were surprised about. People who followed Barry Weiss leaving the New York Times and thought that she had been unjustly treated and went to the Free Press and, you know, as a place that they thought was going to defend freedom of speech, liberal values. And I think it's like pretty undeniable at this point. I mean, Kathy Young, who is someone I think has been a very consistent defender of liberal values, talks about how the Free Press has not really been a place to criticize the Trump administration's mm-hmm. overreach. And I wonder how you feel about that as someone who's worked with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that impressed me about what Barry's done is she did do a good job of gathering around her some of the real talent that was showing some integrity, like mm-hmm. on the internet, like on X, and I do think that actually, you know, her move over to CBS, you know, is going to create a kind of contrast to other news media that actually I think it needs. Mm. To the extent to which, you know, it took on the Trump administration, I wasn't a daily reader to be honest. I don't know enough about the allegations.
Sure. I think the reason why I ask is I think that like this is kind of ties into the question of how these groups and these institutions can get captured by ideological forces.
But I think it's helpful. So just like you were saying mm-hmm. with Musk, I think pre-Musk, the concern was that we all had institutions that had their biases. They were just all pulling in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just like the same way I said the ambition needs to be made to counteract ambition, having institutions that actually pull in different directions can be much healthier for an epistemic environment.
Certainly.
So, yeah, I mean, you're not going to find someone to be the next head of any of these institutions to be the next, you know, head you're not going to have some complaints about.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a contrast to the existing thing, I think we need more of that.
Yeah.
And I think right now having, someone who's coming from a different perspective is what mainstream media needs to a degree, because I think mm-hmm. it has become a somewhat detached bubble.
You, as you mentioned in this interview, are not a free speech absolutist. Like, you believe that there are limits to speech. I think the ones that you've talked about are the ones that are kind of well established in the case law around true threats, targeted harassment, and incitement.
Yeah.
These are, as many cases that you work on, are not always clear-cut cases. Like, mm-hmm. they're incitement in particular, right? Like, what level of someone, talking to a crowd and pumping them up makes them responsible for violent acts they may later commit? This is, like, a question of judgment that lawyers, judges have to make all the time. Can you tell me about a case or something where you felt really cross-pressured on this issue?
I would say, I definitely thought, for example, Trump's speech on January 6th, saying, let's march, let's fight like hell and march on the Capitol, was something that was uncomfortably close to Brandenburg incitement.
Mm.
But I think we were right that it wasn't ultimately there.
Why is that?
Partially because he did actually say peacefully. Mm. There is also the intervening kind of fact of that they had a way to walk, and that essentially, like, the idea of it being imminent and likely to actually happen and include illegal behavior. He definitely had deniability, having said that, you know, he wants them to do it peacefully, mm-hmm. that he was actually saying, don't be peaceful. Mm-hmm. I think, however, it's one of those cases where people who disagreed with us on that, I was like, among First Amendment people, I don't get quite as mad sometimes when people don't actually agree with us. Mm-hmm. You know, I just kind of expect it.
Yeah.
So, like, there are some people who thought, not too many in the First Amendment circles, to be clear, but who thought that maybe that actually reached the level of Brandenburg incitement. Mm-hmm. I think they're wrong, but definitely in terms of, like, something that I'm not used to seeing out of a public official where it's that close. It was, you know, one of the more ferocious debates I've seen in my career.
And right now, we started this episode with asking about the greatest threats of free speech that you see.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing we like to do at The Argument is kind of give people more directionality about how they can actually be a part of improving.
Yeah.
improving that, rather than just sort of dooming for an yeah. hour and a half on a podcast. So, I mean, like, what is, like, an individual's role here? If they're concerned about the threats to free speech happening, particularly, I think, from this administration, when
yeah.
we're seeing, you know, Palestinian protesters having their immigration rights or the due process rights threatened because they are immigrants to this country, or various other ways that they're concerned that law firms or whatever. Like, are there actual steps that people can take to work on this?
I mean, it could be as simple as, you know, sharing stories about it. It mm-hmm. can be, you know, obviously, you know, I'd love people to support FIRE because mm-hmm. we are, frankly, kind of overwhelmed at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the... it is nonstop, and every morning, or at least most mornings, it's like a little First Amendment quiz about whether or not the government is able to get away with what it's trying to pull today. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there are other, you know, other groups as well that are, you know, fighting a good fight,
mm-hmm.
You know, for free speech. When it comes to individual habits,
mm-hmm.
I always try to point people to the very simple older sayings that we have that reflect a culture of free speech. The simplest of being, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. Like, all of these things are basically small L liberalism, because mm-hmm. they're basically like, you know, check yourself here. Like, you're not all knowing. You know, you're an equal democratic citizen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you shouldn't judge someone until you walk a mile in their shoes. You know, like, that's very much that. You should remember things like to each their own, and all of these habits that can remind you, you know, that just because you disagree with something doesn't mean they don't have a right to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this deep pluralism and this deep humility, you know, that actually really helps a democratic society work, that I think we're not really demonstrating on either side of the political fence at the moment. But I do also think you need institutions, you know, teaching this from the very beginning. And I do think you need, you know, more systemic sort of, like, but evidence-based kind of, like, questioning of received wisdom. I think that higher ed, for example, saw itself as just the critique of the entire itself as the institution that critiques the whole rest of society, mm-hmm. and then was routinely bad at critiquing itself.
And the College Compact that the Trump administration
yeah.
has asked the university to sign, how do you think about that as being a framework for university viewpoint diversification?
Yeah, not good.
Yeah.
You know, like, essentially it's incentivizing unconstitutional conditions. It's
mm-hmm.
basically saying that you're supposed to, you know, get rid of entire departments potentially if they're engaged in what, rhetorical violence,
mm-hmm.
is the argument, and are somehow hostile to conservative ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't and shouldn't fly. I definitely want higher ed to reform itself. And I do, the only thing I can say for the compact is that schools are free to reject it.
Mm-hmm.
And so far they have been. And I think, you know, almost all of them are going to. Because otherwise, you know, government sort of coercing groups to get rid of entire departments is not okay.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, as as you were talking earlier, I started thinking about a big thing that really revitalized my interest in political liberalism was recognizing the liberal impulses that I held. And like, once you realize that, like, in yourself you have those, and then you assume, okay, everyone else has them, and it's like, okay, how then do we construct a society where, like, we're not constantly trying to dominate one another? And I do think that, like, people, you know, it can sound really, like, you know, kitschy in some ways, but like, I think it really does start with like how individuals interact with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that there's like all these debates right now about like Democratic Party, the left, etc. You know, why, how is it that they have this the whole country views them as sort of these, you know, intolerant and, you know, two other viewpoints group of people. And a lot of it is cultural in a way that it's difficult for like one person, one candidate to overcome in a speech.
Yeah.
And because at some level, I think there is this perception that, you know, of course, if you hold an opinion, like you think you're right.
Yeah.
Most people think they're right. Otherwise, they wouldn't hold that opinion.
Yeah.
But the way then you approach people who disagree with you as if there's like no way that you could have any be taught anything different, particularly I think coming from people who are more highly educated and I think come from different class backgrounds, it's going to strike people as emblematic of your entire ideological movement in a way that I think is really problematic. And so I do think that, like, you know, people often don't like this kind of like interpersonal individual advice, but I think it's very
useful. I think it matters. There's this wonderful speech by Justice Robert Jackson, and it says, "The true spirit of liberty is that which is not too sure that it is right." And I say this sometimes on campus, and students, like, it sounds like a Zen koan to them. They're like, what? Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, but really, like the, you know, like people might, when people are about to, you know, use coercive power, they should really understand the limitations of what they know. Yeah. I do this exercise, by the way, for like reminding people why due process is important.
Mm.
Think about someone committing a horrible crime against someone in your family.
Yeah.
Imagine the rage that would fill you in those circumstances, or and then imagine that person, you, being the person deciding the guilt of, say, your brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like remember those feelings, project them onto that other person, and then that reminds you of why you need due process. Yeah. Because like, that person is not an evil person.
Yeah.
They don't have to be an evil person to be wrong on this stuff. You just have to be, you can be filled with a righteous passion, but it doesn't make you right.
Yeah.
And that's why you need those protections.
So that experience like that remind me, I mean, you've done polling on, Fire's done polling on this, the argument has done polling on free speech attitudes. And, you know, we don't have free speech polling all the way back to like the 1500s or whatever, but I would expect that very rarely do you have large majorities of people who are in favor of free speech at the extent to which we're talking about on this podcast. Yeah. I think people in general are like, there are types of speech that they find abhorrent, offensive, that they think, you know, if someone asks them like, hey, do you think it should be unacceptable? Maybe they don't believe the government should throw you in jail for it, but they would be okay with a range of things that you would consider constitutionally protected speech. And I mean, we're seeing this in our polling now that the majority of Americans are, you know, we asked this about, you know, whether someone advocating only marriage between a man and a woman on a campus, a majority of liberals said, no, that person shouldn't be allowed to speak on campus.
Yeah.
We asked about a transgender rights activist, majority of conservatives said they don't think that person should be allowed to speak on campus. I mean, and we also asked in a bunch of different contexts what people should be allowed to do. And it got me thinking, like, if you were to poll liberalism throughout history and poll free speech in particular, I don't think you'd get majority support there.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's right.
Really? I mean, we can't know, obviously. Yeah.
And it definitely is the case that even just throughout my career, you know, the polling has gotten a lot worse among young people.
Sure.
So like, clearly, like, it's not just we were doing something at least better or doing something wrong now.
Yeah. But like, you know, even before it got worse in polling, the Dixie Chicks, right? After they criticized Bush, and I think on today's terms, like, very mild language.
Very, very tame.
I mean, they're canceled.
Yeah.
Like, for a long time, they're canceled through their jobs, they're canceled, you know, in ways that I think we would consider, you know, not a great culture. I mean, this happens all the time throughout history in ways, and that was popular. People were very in favor of that happening. They thought they were inappropriate.
I didn't know any of the people who were in favor of
you're in your free speech bubble, Greg. That's the problem. But I mean, it was very popular. I mean, people thought that they had overstepped, and that was, I mean, Americans in general.
Yeah, so, but know, I mean, like, you know, looking at polling going back to, like, the 70s and that kind of stuff, I say this sometimes. you should not assume that, like, no, like, there's this way of dismissing, like, this argument that really annoys me, which is the, you're just positing some kind of great golden age of freedom of speech. I'm like, I'm really not. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you think it's always been as bad as it currently is, that's also self-deceived. Because yeah. I'd say, like let's take the sort of, like, euphoria of the post, like, when the wall came down and when Eastern Europe was liberated. The idea was that liberalism had won, and small-L liberalism, free speech liberalism. And that sort of euphoria lasted until about 2005, you know, when Larry Diamond, you know, pointed out, like, the whole democratic recession really beginning. But I do think that there are that we can't, you know, be pessimistic about it just because, oh, we've never been that good on it. We have been better, is I think, pretty clear in history. Yeah.
Well, Greg, always our last and final question. What is a take that has really irritated you recently? It can be a book you've come across, it can be a tweet, it can be an article, it can be advice you've been given.
So I'm spending so much time defending higher ed at the moment, and defending higher ed from the Trump administration, that having the American Association of University Professors, which is constantly doing stuff like this, come out with an article called Seven Arguments Against Viewpoint Diversity. Just right at this time, saying that one of the great lines is, like, viewpoint diversity is anathema to academic freedom. And it's this whole, it's not a well-made argument.
Yeah.
And it's, like, also the worst imaginable time to be making this argument, where it's kind of like, okay, guys, like, we're defending you against the Trump administration right now.
Yeah.
And you can't admit that there's anything wrong in your institutions at all.
Yeah.
Which is just, like, it was, so I wrote a piece in on my Substack. It's a little more kind of like, are you, you know, like, it's a little more frustrated. It was me, Sam Abrams, and Adam Goldstein wrote a piece about it, because I just found this just so, like, helping.
I haven't read it, but is the sentiment of the argument that, of course, if you were selecting for merit, that some viewpoints would win out others? For instance, like, you wouldn't pick people who were who believed that the Earth didn't revolve around the sun. Is that what they're saying?
They pick QAnon and flat earthers. Because, of course, to disagree with sociology professors on anything is basically being
a flat earther.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it's just, like, so funny. Some of these arguments, like, I mean, people have made a lot of arguments against free speech that are better than this. Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.